Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Richard Martin here from Miami, Florida, with the wake-up call, hope you all had a wonderful weekend. We are ready to face the rigors of the week, and we're going to have a special guest on the show today. His name is Burton W. Folsom, and he's going to be talking about his new book called New Deal or Raw Deal, How FDR's Economic Legacy Has Damaged America. Now, you will all know to the extent to which I believe that the seeds for the current problems were planted most definitely in the New Deal. And, of course, I've scrummaged around as much as I could to do research into that particular facet of American history. And I haven't come up with very much. I have mentioned this on a few occasions. And then, to my great delight and surprise, out pops a book by Mr. Folsom on this very subject. And I can assure you it is extremely convincing in the regard to how little or no thought was given to the long-term prospects of the New Deal, or even, for that matter, the short-term ones. The book itself takes a sharply critical new look at Franklin Roosevelt's presidency. It reveals government policies that hindered economic recovery from the Great Depression and are still hurting America today. And reading from the book blurb, it says, in this shocking and groundbreaking new book, economic historian Burton W. Folsom exposes the idyllic legend of Franklin D. Roosevelt as a myth of epic proportions, with questionable moral character and a vendetta against the business elite. Roosevelt created New Deal programs marked by inconsistent planning, wasteful spending, and opportunity for political gain, ultimately elevating public opinion of his administration but falling flat in achieving the economic revitalization that America so desperately needed from the Great Depression. Folsom takes a critical, revisionist look at Roosevelt's presidency, his economic policies, and his personal life. Elected in 1932 on a buoyant tide of promises to balance the increasingly uncontrollable national budget and reduce the catastrophic unemployment rate, the charismatic 32nd president not only neglected to pursue those goals, he made dramatic changes to federal programming that directly contradicted his campaign promises. Price-fixing, court-packing, regressive taxes, and patronism were all hidden inside the alphabet soup of his popular New Deal, putting a financial strain on the already suffering lower classes and discouraging the upper classes from taking business risks that potentially could have jostled national cash flow from dormancy. Many government programs that are widely used today have their seeds in the New Deal. Farm subsidies, minimum wage, and welfare, among others, all stifle economic growth, encouraging decreased productivity and exacerbating unemployment. Roosevelt's imperious approach to the presidency changed American politics forever, and as he manipulated public opinion, American citizens became unwitting accomplices to the stilted economic growth of the 1930s. More than 60 years after FDR died in office, we still struggle with the damaging repercussions of his legacy. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think you will agree that our little talk with Mr. Folsom should be very interesting and produce a lot of food for thought. and I look forward to having him with us in about 10 minutes. Meanwhile, let me just quickly give you my information. This is Richard Martin of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, we are coming to you live from Miami through New York at the Progressive Radio Network. And what I would like very much for you to do is to call in and ask Mr. Folsom questions during this next hour. He will be very happy to answer your questions, and he will do so when he starts to speak. Needless to say, you may ask him any questions of your choice. He is clearly has done a tremendous amount of research on his project and is extremely knowledgeable. He happened to be on the Book TV segment of C-SPAN over the weekend, which my wife was kind enough to bring to my attention. And I will ask him, hopefully, some interesting questions pertaining to our own philosophy here on the Wake Up Call. Before we do that, though, let's just deal with a few questions. I have so many questions, it's really hard to know where to go with all my listeners' questions, and I'm so glad that you do ask them, and I will endeavor to get round as many as possible as quickly as we can. We had an anonymous mail. I know who it's from, but the reader has asked me, or rather the listener has asked me, to withhold his name. So anonymous, please, has written, "Dear Richard, with the coming collapse of government services, and in particular those applied to law enforcement, I do imagine that some communities will be subject not only more muggings and home invasions, the latter especially when mattress cash balances are known to increase, but to out-and-out regional gangster taxes. If I were a manager of the Mafia, Russian mob, the Bloods, Crips, or Latin Kings, I would be licking my chops at the coming opportunities. Private guard services could well turn out to be a nightmare when they realize the advantages of holding the guns. Home defense weaponry might be a last resort, and only that. No solution, just thoughts." From Anonymous. Well, yes, I tend to agree with that, Anonymous. I think that we are looking at a very grim period ahead. I have no idea how long it will last, but we will obviously need to say our prayers for this country, because it's going to transcend economic considerations, in my opinion, and move into the realm of social cataclysm. But I'm not trying to be dramatic here. I'm trying to extrapolate the future from the present, which is clearly, economically speaking, spun quite completely out of control. Let's take Steve's rant, or one of them, came in on January the 15th, entitled "Ethics American Style." Our president-elect's, well, of course he's president by now, our president-elect's latest representative of change being defined as the names change but the policy does not, Tim Geithner, to be put in as top gun at Treasury. Man, what a choice. As the head of the New York Federal Reserve, he had a heavy hand in the causation of our problems in the first place. And now it is discovered that he forgot to pay $42,000 in income taxes. Richard, how in the hell can a man being considered for Treasury Secretary forget to pay $42,000 in income tax? I say, forgot has to be a lie. And if it is not a lie, then this man is a complete idiot. I would think, working in Europe for the IMF, he must have thought, if they don't withhold the tax, the hell with them, I'll just ignore it. Whatever the reason, he knew better, and all those in Congress reviewing his appointment know damn well he is lying. A few senators interviewed are quoted as saying, no big deal, he most likely just forgot. Richard, to compound this problem, he has an illegal alien working in his house. That alone should disqualify him for this high position. The illegal alien charge in the past was all that was needed to cause the person being considered for the cabinet position to withdraw their own name for consideration. I really do think we have to redefine the word ethics. Today, ethics means, when accused, just say, I forgot, it's no big deal, don't say much at all, look down a lot, and if you're well-connected, you'll get the job. Richard, we seem to have hit an all-time low on a daily basis. I am certain this tax-evading slave owner will be approved, and his name will be on our dollar. Well, of course, Steve. Well, thank you, Steve. He was approved, as we all know. And doubtless his name will start up, his face will appear on our dollar, or his signature, wherever it comes up on the dollars these days. Frank Devlin came in the same day with a mini rant here. I thought it was worth letting you know. He says, Richard, there just isn't enough plain speaking regarding almost anything to do with government. The rescue is a prime example of that. The following, quoted from a reader of Agora Financial's five-minute forecast, drives that point home. The author repeats your often stated position, the government produces nothing. Quote, all these suggestions fail to address the fundamental problem with government, namely that government does not produce anything. The stimulus money that everyone is getting so worked up about has to be borrowed, begged, or stolen from someone if one doesn't have the ability to create value. Borrowed, begged, or stolen, that's it. I would suggest it will not be begged, which leaves two alternatives. Few people expect the mafia to be able to fix any problems in an economy, yet they all idiotically look to government to fix these same problems. Even fewer realize that there is little real difference between the two. Let them all get what they deserve. Servitude. End of quote. Of course, continues Frank, this is standard government fare, as well as mafia, so they, the government, are unusually well-suited to administer this folly. Some argue, with a skillful, desperate spin to it, we have to give up some freedoms for financial security. Hand out Hank and Zimbabwe Ben come to mind, but we will not get any more security by this thievery than if we dealt with the mob. Come to think of it, in the spirit of plain speaking, we should call Washington what it is, the mob. The boss and the boys should suffice for Mr. President and honorable, an oxymoron if ever I heard one, members of Congress. From the foxhole, Frank. Okay, well, I think I will read you an email which I received. In fact, I've been waiting for an email like this somewhat in opposition to my talk of the 5th of January about leaving the United States. We're not going to have time to deal with it today, and I was going to deal with it before I was fortunate enough to secure the time of Bert Folsom, but I thought it was worth letting you have an alternative side to this question of leaving the United States, which, as I say, I had expected to come up at some point, and sure enough, it came up last January the 22nd, after the show, and it comes from Russell Johnson, and it's entitled Response to Your Show, and I read as follows. Hi, Richard. In the last few shows you have had on, I have come to realize that it would be wrong to bail out on America now. This country, true, has its problems, but so do all. For me to give up on my country now would be like me giving up on my family now. This country has fed me and it has done me good. Yes, things could be much better in my life, but things could be much worse. So our country now needs our help, and it is our duty to help it out and not give up on it. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, when I read words with emphasis, it means that they have been capitalized in the script. So that's why I sort of give emphasis to certain words as opposed to others. Continuing, okay, it reminds me of me. I am not the easiest of brothers or sons to get along with in my family, and the most important thing that has mattered the most is that they do not give up on me because I am hard to be around or deal with. The same goes for my country. It might be easier for you to pack up and leave because you were born of another country already. Singapore has its problems, and things are going to get worse there too, as they already are. Please, instead of recommending to people how to get out of here, please as payback for all of the good that has come your way since living here, I know a lot of good has come your way too, start pointing out more things that we, as committed Americans, can do to help this big problem that we face and help over the airwaves with projects and information that we can use to come together and give back for the good life that most of us have enjoyed by living here. Let us start thinking of programs that we can come up with to get business to start back up again and get positive information that can help people be motivated to support our government with the help it needs. Let us stop leaving it all up to government to fix everything, and then when they do it wrong, just yell at them and point fingers. We, the people, can help to turn things around and stay positive instead of creating fear. You are making it sound like it is so easy to just pack our bags and get out. I believe in this country, and I would like to help with something positive to be read from an email. In God, I trust. Amen. Russ in Virginia. Well, as I said, I don't have time to deal with this now, but it provides food for thought. And if any of you have any comments that you would like either to give out over the air here in future broadcasts, or if you would like to write me an email, you may most certainly do so, and I will be glad to deal with them on the program. Now, I am informed that Bert is now on the air, and just before I bring you on, Bert, let me just give out the number, the toll-free number that all of you can use to talk to Bert if you feel that you would like to ask him a question. And I know that he would be very happy to answer your questions. The toll-free number is 1-888-873-4643. Once more, the number to call if you would like to speak to Bert is 888-873-4643. The lines will be open. There are several lines, so several of you can call and just be put on hold by our engineer, and then I will let you ask your question when Bert gives us an appropriate moment to do so. So with that, I would like to welcome onto our show Bert Folsom. Hello, Bert. It's nice to have you on the air with us today.
Hello, Richard. Good to be here.
Bert is a professor of history at Hillsdale College in Michigan and senior historian at the Foundation for Economic Education in Irvington, New York. He is a regular columnist for The Freeman and has written articles for The Wall Street Journal and American Spectator, among other publications. He lives in Michigan. Well, Bert, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us today.
Sure.
You have your new book, which I have already mentioned, which we think is, at least I think, is very much relevant to our situation today, given all the things that have been happening courtesy of the government, which look to me as though they are going directly down the path of the 1930s. Bert's book is called New Deal or Raw Deal: How FDR's Economic Legacy Has Damaged America. But you talk a lot in the book about Roosevelt, and
yes,
kindly dispel our impressions of Roosevelt, hopefully, because obviously here was a man, not actually, in my opinion, unlike Abraham Lincoln, who has been very much misunderstood and held out as an icon when, in fact, he was just an ordinary, scrubby, everyday politician like the rest of them. In the book, you say, and I'd just like to quote a couple of passages here because I think they're very relevant. Given Roosevelt, this is straight from Bert's book, and he says, given Roosevelt's wealth and opportunity, it is surprising to discover that he was not gifted in the field of economics in general or in business in particular. In part, his family's wealth immunized him from having to learn how business worked or how to earn money. His mother, to quote, money was never discussed at home, his mother Sarah revealed. Living as we did in the country, there was no opportunity for spending it. All his books and toys were provided for him. She added, we never subjected the boy to a lot of don'ts. I thought that was very revealing. I'd never heard that before, because I'm not, you know, very much knowledgeable in American affairs. But nevertheless, it was very interesting to read that and to quote another passage from the same chapter.
Sure.
Much of Roosevelt's Harvard experience was a replay of Groton, I don't know how to pronounce that. He did not make the football team again and was relegated to the cheering section. His grades were mediocre, a C to C-plus average. He tended to avoid the academic world of homework, study, and research. Instead, he focused on the social, political world of clubs, public debates, and journalism. His record was again mixed. He was accepted into membership of The Fly, a prominent social club, and did become editor of The Crimson, the school newspaper. But he was rejected for membership in The Porcellian, the oldest and most elite social club at Harvard. Since his father had made Porcellian, as did Teddy Roosevelt and his two sons, that public failure was especially galling to him. 15 years later, he confessed to a relative that his rejection by Porcellian was, quote, the greatest disappointment of my life, unquote. But Porcellian members were future entrepreneurs, bankers, and corporate lawyers. Roosevelt was a future politician. Well, that's an amazing thing to discover about Roosevelt. I bet there aren't, you know, 1 in 1,000 people who know this. There's just one more which I can't resist quoting here, Bert, if you'll just bear with me, because it's so interesting. After graduating from Harvard, Roosevelt tried to find his niche in law school in Columbia, but his record again was not one of distinction. According to one of his professors, Jackson Reynolds, quote, Franklin Roosevelt was not much of a student at Columbia and nothing of a lawyer afterwards. He didn't appear to have any aptitude for law and made no effort to overcome that handicap by hard work. He was not a worker and he flunked, end of quote. Although he did pass Jackson's course, he flunked 2 others. He never did finish law school, but he passed the bar exam and was thus open for employment in one of New York's law firms. Roosevelt married his cousin Eleanor during this time. President Theodore Roosevelt gave away the bride, but the marriage was one of convenience. In Roosevelt's generation, most graduates of Groton and Harvard went into banking, law, or business. The problem, of course, is that Roosevelt didn't have the aptitude in those areas. Well, that's an amazing thing. I mean, I'm a...
Yes.
What is your... first of all, you know, what interests me is how you came by this whole idea of bringing up the New Deal in terms of the current problems.
Sure. Right. The New Deal has been a real watershed period in American history. In the 1930s, we really went in the direction of seeking more intervention by the federal government to solve problems. And so it seemed to me, when I began the research several years ago, that if we wanted to understand what was happening today, the antecedents or the precedents of the 1930s would be important to understanding today. Of course, now that we have had the situation we're in with the economic crisis, the parallels seem even more relevant. But the 1930s was a remarkable decade because never before in American history had we ventured into massive federal spending to the extent that we did in the 1930s, and so I thought that was worthy of study. Roosevelt, of course, as the president during that period, is the focal point of the book, New Deal or Raw Deal.
Well, I mean, Roosevelt, obviously, I assume, was the brains behind this. I mean, you know, one
yes.
hears about Roosevelt, and I've never really known whether that meant that Roosevelt himself was the kind of brains powerhouse behind the New Deal or whether he was just the spokesman for it.
Right. No, he was behind it. He was a very shrewd politician. The fact that he was not very good in economics and that he had very little aptitude for business and was not very successful as a student in school should not keep us from recognizing that he had great political instincts and political skills. He was a good political speaker. He had the ability to connect with the American people in his fireside chats. He was innovative, using the radio for those purposes. But actually, his program was not very sound. And part of that, I look back to his work in school and his knowledge of business. He really just didn't understand business and economics very well. And so we really, in some ways, had the wrong man in a position of authority at a time when we really needed someone who had a greater understanding of economics.
See, the way I see it is that a president cannot be all things to all men. He can't be an expert
right.
in every area. And specifically today, for example, when you have Obama, who's a constitutional expert, but probably knows next to nothing about economics. And so he has to depend on his henchmen to give him the views and opinions. I mean, I always feel about Obama that he is so intelligent that if anybody really was to get in between him and these people who advise him, he would actually see things very differently. But I don't think that intellectually one can compare Obama to Roosevelt.
Right. Obama needs to get a variety of different points of view. Roosevelt was not really interested in receiving a lot of information from people who did not agree with the direction in which he was headed. And you end up with situations like our farming program, you know, the AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Act. Here we have 20 to 25% unemployment. We have lots of people hungry. And so he comes up with a program to pay people not to produce. You know, it's a bizarre program to pay people out of the national treasury not to produce when we have people who are going hungry. It's an odd program, and of course it did not work well. But Roosevelt became committed to it, and it helped him get votes from farmers because he discovered that farmers enjoyed being paid not to grow crops on some of their acreage. And because they were receiving money from the federal government, they ended up voting Democratic, even though the program did not at all help us to reduce unemployment or to feed people or to get out of the Great Depression.
See, one of the things that I feel very strongly about is that the New Deal actually did sow the seeds for the current problems that we're in today.
Yes.
It's difficult, I think, for most Americans to put the pieces together, to join the dots, as it were, from way back in the 1930s. Do you actually feel the same way? And if so, what particular kind of programs do you think were initiated in the 30s that have sort of given us problems that we've inherited today?
Sure. I think a lot of the whole idea that you can take money and tax dollars, you know, shovel it, take it out of the hands of taxpayers, and then have people in authority like Roosevelt or the director of the AAA or the director of the WPA and siphon that money into particular political districts and make it create employment is an idea that they believed in the 1930s, but clearly you can see is not true. It just didn't work, and by the end of the 1930s, we still had about 20% unemployment because all the jobs that we created, for example, on the Works Projects Administration, the WPA, building roads or building schools, were taken by money that could have been used in the private sector to create jobs. By having then high taxes to get that money, and most people don't realize the tax rate that Roosevelt instituted in 1935, he raised the income tax to a top rate of 79%. Well, when you tell entrepreneurs that you're going to take four out of every $5 they earn and put it into programs that Roosevelt himself is going to be responsible for, and that he only gets to keep one out of every $5, we found that people just weren't very anxious to start businesses. And the absence of those businesses perpetuated the Great Depression.
The book is called New Deal or Raw Deal: How FDR's Economic Legacy Has Damaged America. I believe it came out in November of last year. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct.
We have a caller, actually, I think and hope that he wants to ask you a question. Here's George from New York standing by. George, are you there?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
My question is a bit off topic. The Federal Reserve System, how does that differ from Alexander Hamilton's concept of a central bank?
You're right. Hamilton had a concept of a central bank. And the bank would, there's a little bit of a difference, but there are some principles that you just said there that are parallel. For example, in the Bank of the United States, the government was allowed to take, the bank was capitalized at $10 million, but that's money that savers voluntarily put into the bank. That wasn't out of tax revenue. That was money people put in with the expectation of getting an interest rate. But it was the largest bank in the country, the Bank of the United States. And the idea is that the directors of the bank and Hamilton himself would then pick winners and losers for good investments because the bank would be the biggest bank and could afford to make big loans to people. But I say one key difference here is that that wasn't taken out of tax revenue. That was taken by savers who put their money in the Bank of the United States. And then the central direction of the bank loan money to people, but see, even then they didn't do a very good job of picking winners and losers. For example, we couldn't tell in the 1790s and early 1800s that the textile industry was going to be a big industry. They were reluctant to make loans to the textile industry. They were reluctant to make loans to Eli Whitney with his interchangeable parts and his rifles. You end up getting it politicized. They end up making loans to cousins, to friends, to people who are politically well-connected, and it's very difficult for a small group of people to figure out, hey, what are going to be the winning industries in this country? And the Bank of the United States was not very successful in that, and eventually Andrew Jackson stopped the Second Bank of the United States, and it was an experiment that was in the early part of our history that we did not continue after about 1835.
Thank you for the question, George, and thanks for the response, Bert. The line to call in if you'd like to ask Bert a question is 888 873 8888-4643. Again, the number to call if you would like to ask Bob Folsom a question is 888-873-4643. I just got an email from Bill Farmer, who tells me that Bert's talk on Book TV, which I think you, how long ago did you record that, Bert?
That was recorded in December last year at the Heritage Foundation, but it's been aired four times in January.
I see. Well, it's available for viewing, according to Bill Farmer. You can see it if you will go to booktv.org. That will allow you to get an in-depth view of Bert's book from Bert himself on the weekend Book TV series that C-SPAN put out. So please go to that. But could you talk a little about a lot of you discuss a lot the NRA, the National Industrial Recovery Act, that was finally shortened to the National Recovery Act.
Yes.
Perhaps you could talk about that, because that is absolutely pivotal to your thesis and your book.
Yes, it is. The National Recovery Act was dealing with the idea of how do you jumpstart businesses? How do you get businesses to be more successful? Now, of course, one way would be to cut taxes so that they have incentives to invest. But, of course, Roosevelt didn't want to do that because he wanted to tax a lot of income in order that he could have his road building program with his WPA and pay the farmers not to produce. So what he had instead was the National Recovery Act, and what he allowed businesses to do, he allowed industrialists to get together, for example, car makers, and decide how much they would charge for their cars. He would allow tire makers to get together and decide what they would charge for their tires. Once they came to an agreement on what ought to be charged, those rates became legally binding, and Americans had to pay those prices. And any businessman who cut the price to give a customer a discount ran the risk of going to jail, and we did indeed have some people go to jail for charging, for giving customers discounts. It was a remarkable period in our history.
You see, it's interesting because this whole concept of the bailouts and the, the banks receiving money, the basic idea, even though they won't admit it, of course, the basic idea is to keep prices high. It's a repetition of the same idea
that they had
in the past, that we must force the prices of these things higher. And I don't think that probably happened in the 30s. It just went straight to the legislation forcing those prices higher through the NRA. Do you foresee? I mean, clearly the banks won't lend the money today. So therefore, if the banks aren't lending the money, there's not much they can do. The deflationary wave continues and life goes on. Do you foresee the possibility that the government will start to legislate these things in the same way that they did in the 30s?
It's possible, and one of the lessons is that in the 1930s, when we did begin to do the legislating that you're talking about, Richard, that it didn't work, that it didn't work well, and that ultimately when we began to get government out of the hands of individual lives and we let people choose to buy the products they want and they don't have the interference from the heavy taxes, that people tend to make better choices than government agencies make for how to spend money and how to create prosperity.
All right. Well, now, here's the $64 million question, then. I mean, the question that everybody wants to ask, and nobody is ever going to get an answer to unless somebody like yourself, you know, shines the light of day on this thing. If the economists who are behind all these programs today are aware of the things that you expound on and that you've been talking about, why are they offering the same kind of programs today?
You ask such a that's a very good question, because what you're saying is, in effect, they didn't work in the 1930s. In fact, they didn't even work when Jimmy Carter was trying some of them in the 1970s. He tried kind of a WPA with the Humphrey Hawkins bill. And why are we going back and trying variations of some of these same programs today? And the answer, it's a very good question, and I think we really need to try to address that. One reason is, just because the program doesn't work for the nation doesn't mean that there aren't some people who are getting some benefits out of that program. For example, the town of Natchez, Mississippi, is trying to get a $9 million sports center that is funded under the stimulus package. They're hoping to get $9 million to build a sports center, and that that will be part of the stimulus package. Now, you can see where that building, that $9 million sports complex in Natchez, would be good for creating jobs in Natchez. The problem is it would be done with $9 million of taxpayer money coming from elsewhere, and those jobs would be lost somewhere else and concentrated in Natchez, at least for that one program. Now, my point would simply be, As an idea, a stimulus package, taking money from taxpayers and putting it into a program, that doesn't create jobs, but you can see the reshuffling can help individual cities or individual farmers in the case of the AAA. If you're paid not to produce, that doesn't help the nation, but it certainly does help an individual farmer's wallet to be paid not to produce, so that you have some people who are benefiting from receiving tax dollars, even though the nation doesn't benefit. And it is in their interest, in the interest of farmers in the AAA, in the interest of the people of Natchez, Mississippi, to try to create these kinds of programs because they can get free money at the expense of other people. And so you say, hey, look, this will create jobs. We have a sports center here, and we have people employed to build it. And so it looks as though jobs are being created. What you don't see are the jobs lost because people could not buy products that they otherwise would have been able to buy if their $9 million didn't get shoveled into Natchez, Mississippi. Or in the case of the AAA and the New Deal, where the farmers were being paid not to produce, they were receiving tax dollars from taxpayers who could have bought other products which would have stimulated the economy, but they couldn't do that because their money went to Washington to be distributed to farmers who were being paid not to produce. So some people, it's a key point, some people benefit individually even though the nation as a whole doesn't benefit, and so you have an incentive for people and for towns and to come up with projects saying, hey, this will help the economy, even though it really will not help the national economy. That's point number one, Richard. And the second point, and this is also important, and that is the politicians have incentives to go along with this because, in effect, they can get votes. Roosevelt understood very quickly, even though his programs were not helping the Great Depression, even though we continued to have 15% and 20% unemployment, that he was winning votes because he was shoveling tax dollars into different political districts, winning the votes of those districts. It was not helping the nation because we were taking the money from one source to give to another. But those people who received the tax benefits, the roads, the schools, those farmers being paid not to produce, they liked him and they ended up voting for him. So what I'm saying is politicians have incentives to come up with these programs because they can get votes. Individual people have incentives to come up with these programs because maybe they can get the money shoveled in their direction or be paid not to produce or whatever. But the nation itself does not benefit, and we did not create new jobs. And at the end of 6 years of the New Deal, we still had 20% unemployment. And if we continue that path under President Obama, it's not likely to help the American economy.
Okay, again, thank you, Bert. The book is called New Deal or Raw Deal, How FDR's Economic Legacy Has Damaged America. We have a caller from Long Island, Arthur. Arthur, you are on the line.
Hello.
Hi. Hello, Arthur.
Hi, how you doing, Bert? It's great listening to your conversation. But I have a couple of things that I'd like to comment on.
Sure.
One is that when you said that they really didn't have any knowledge of choosing products that would be correct back to, during the Roosevelt period of time, nothing has really changed in that format because really the capital that's needed for introduction of products and so on really stays where they have protected interests or where they feel secure. And
yes,
new products are really things that are not don't have viability at the moment, but their potential is not seen until after they actually have made waves in the economy. And I think that that's true today.
Yes.
Capital is protecting its money and not really looking at things that could be a very viable or good market in the future. And if somebody does want to put their capital into something, they're really looking at venture capitalists on really controlling what the future benefit would be of these things. So I don't think anything has really changed. People, you would look at the, let's say, the alternative energy issue, and the people that are controlling the marketplace, they certainly aren't going to put money toward things that are going to reduce their total income. So we have the same thing today where there may be very good things for the society and the culture, but they're not going to be capital. There's not going to be any capital there for them because the capital is going to stay in the rules of what they feel capital growth is. And the other thing I thought was interesting is that when you say that Roosevelt did these things for the farmers because it was politically correct, he could get votes for giving them money.
Right.
The same thing is true today. I mean, they go along because they can get the votes. Whoever controls the money controls the elections of the office and the media, et cetera. So the same game is here true today. If whatever party somebody is trying to be elected to, Democrat or Republican, if they don't seek the money, they will not get elected. And as
right.
we have now.
And you have an incentive to get a subsidy because otherwise you'll be left paying the tax dollars for other people to get the program.
That's correct. So, I mean, like Wall Street is a player today. And so they're controlling what's happening with the whole banking industry is so corrupt in the sense that it only has consciousness of the capital and how to save and protect and grow their capital, and it doesn't have any real responsibility to the society or the culture. That's the comments I wanted to make.
Well, I think they're very good comments, and you can never tell, relating especially to your first comment about what venture capital might come up with. In the 1920s, right before the decade before the Great Depression, we tried serious tax cuts. We had a top income tax rate coming into the 1920s of 73%. And we then got a depression, a slight depression, because we couldn't get the soldiers from World War I to work. And so we had high unemployment. We had 12% unemployment. And we haven't had very many periods in our history where we had as much as 12% unemployment. And so Harding and Coolidge tried the tax cut scheme. And we cut the top rate down to 25%. And we took 98% of all Americans off the tax rolls entirely. And the end result of that was that you had this spurring of new capital for businesses, but there were products that we never even realized might be successful. For example, air conditioning was invented, or it was actually invented earlier, but it in the 1920s was when it really became popularized. And Willis Carrier, who invented it, never really until the tax cuts had incentive to really massively try to produce air conditioning on a big scale. Well, that made a tremendous difference in American history. I mean, inventions like Scotch tape and the zipper, sliced bread,
right,
came in the 1920s. Radio became popular in the 20s. Vacuum cleaners, more widely used. Refrigerators. But the thing is, it was hard to tell before that those were the good products that consumers would want to buy. The only way you could tell that was by getting government out, letting consumers choose the industries they wanted, and let entrepreneurs try to produce the products they would want. The end result under Coolidge was we only averaged 3.3% unemployment during his 6 years in the presidency. We had 12% going in to begin the decade of the 1920s. It was cut to 3.3. And so I think that's the formula for success and not the formula of having the government pick winners and losers by various federal programs.
Thank you, gentlemen. We have an emailed question from Frank Devlin, Bert.
Okay.
He says, Richard, what would Bert recommend, if anything, the government do to deal with our current financial crisis?
That's a good question, and the implication of the answer was in when you look at what we did right in the 1920s, and I would say cut tax rates, cut the capital gains rate, because the solution is not with government. The solution is with people, and people investing and taking chances. Give them a stable environment to invest, cut the capital gains tax, cut the federal income tax, and that would be helpful. And then reduce federal spending, because then if you reduce federal spending, we do not have the burden of interest payments on the national debt that consumes so much of our wealth. The less of our national wealth that is consumed by federal debt, the more freedom we have to invest and the more freedom we have to create jobs. So I would say the government's the best thing they can do is create a stable investment climate and encourage entrepreneurs to invest by substantially reducing capital gains and the income tax. And if the 1920s is any illustration, we would come out of that recession very, very quickly in a matter of a year or two.
Well, of course, I think most sane-minded people would agree with you, but the problem, of course, is that the government isn't going to do that. The government is going to continue along the lines that have been laid out. Geithner has lent his full weight and force behind this, and, of course, so has Obama.
But I'm not discouraged. Now, let me tell you, Richard, why I'm not discouraged. And that is, number one, we have historical examples from the 20s and 30s of what worked and what didn't work. As long as we can trot those out, and as you're doing on your show here, get these ideas out, at least get people to consider them. Some people may be listening and thinking, well, I just don't know if less government is better. It seems to me as though we need to get government to centralize programs, and maybe they'll work this time. Well, maybe they will. If they do for the first time, then that will be helpful. But if they don't, then by having this discussion, we create an atmosphere in which we can come up with alternate solutions if these programs don't work, and I don't think they will. But if they do work, that's good, and that helps the economy. If they don't, then we have alternative ways. We can say, okay, this didn't work. Let's try something else. Let's try the tax cuts. Let's see. It has worked in the past. Let's try it this time. Maybe we can create a climate of ideas in which different ideas can be discussed. We can historically look at what worked and didn't work so that if this round of stimulus package programs doesn't work, we have something to fall back on for the next phase.
Yeah, but the problem, surely, Bert, you would agree with me, is that in the 1920s and 30s, the United States was a creditor nation. Today, the country is indebted by degrees that would never have been contemplated in the 1920s and 30s. So the solutions which might have applied then might very well not apply. I mean, all this debt requires interest payments. It's taken on a momentum of its own. It's not just going to stop dead in its tracks. I mean, there's going to have to be some kind of critical denouement, which is going to allow the system to unwind in some way, in some manner, shape, or form, you know, like the way they tried in the 30s, adopting a gold standard at a much higher gold price, thereby robbing Americans of the value of all the gold that they had been obliged to hand in.
That's right.
I mean, these were extreme measures, but if they had to use extreme measures at a time when this country was a creditor nation, what kind of extreme measures are going to deal with the gigantic and growing deficit that we have today?
Well, I think you raise a good question there, but one thing that you were talking about Roosevelt's gold policies. By increasing the price of gold from $20 to $35, which is what Roosevelt did after confiscating and paying people's gold for the $20, he just really increased the amount of money that the federal government had, which is really not a very honest thing to do. And it certainly didn't get us out of the Great Depression. But I would say this: you know, you're making this point on the creditor nation. What could be good? What could be better as far as restoring American credibility and increasing American credit than to have results from tax cuts that spur investment, but also improve the revenue side? In the 1920s, when we made those tax cuts, we actually increased by 30% the federal revenue. We went from $700 million to $1 billion by the end of the decade in the 1920s for income tax revenue. In other words, when we had a 70% tax, 70% of about, we had very little investment, so 70% of almost nothing was nothing. When the rate was cut down to 25%, we had a lot more investment, so 25% of a lot of investment was a lot of federal revenue. We balanced the budget. When we cut those taxes, Richard, we had budget surpluses every single year of Coolidge's administration, and we reduced one-third of the entire American national debt during the 1920s.
But that was still at a time of a gold standard where the discipline of the Fed was imposed upon it by the very gold standard that impeded them from printing money at will, wasn't it? I mean, today you don't have that anymore. So,
well, now you're
that's
right.
That's why these enormous bailouts are made possible. They wouldn't have been possible in the 20s and 30s because the gold standard would simply have prevented that kind of money being printed.
Well, now, when you hit the gold standard in that respect versus the Federal Reserve, you do have a point. But I would merely suggest that if we could begin to have balanced budgets, and we did do so when we cut taxes in the 1920s, that would then be an incentive for the Federal Reserve not to print so much money because we're having surpluses, not deficits. The incentive to print that money comes when you have deficits. And if you're running surpluses, you don't have the incentive to print up money because you're more than balancing your budgets. Therefore,
don't these things play? Don't they play into each other? It's a kind of loop feedback effect,
right,
isn't it? You have the surpluses because you have the gold standard, and you have the gold standard, which means that you don't need you have the surpluses, and therefore you don't need to print the money. And the not printing of the money again is a function of the surplus, and all these things, you know, depend on each other. But now we have a nightmarish situation where there is a black hole and there's no impeding the printing of money, and money appears to be, you know, the drug that the patient needs to continue to survive. And therefore, the patient just gets more of that drug. And I think that's going to happen in the UK, which is teetering, apparent to all appearances, today on the verge of bankruptcy.
Well, that would indeed be sad if the UK, if that were to happen in the UK. I would merely suggest, because you made a good point there, is that and possibly we need to be returned to the gold standard. But I would suggest that having budget surpluses, which is much more likely with cutting the capital gains and the income tax, which is it's surprising because that's counterintuitive. You wouldn't necessarily think that. But historically, that's the way that it worked in the 20s and even to some extent in the 1980s, to a lesser extent in the 80s. But I would merely say that would be an incentive for the Federal Reserve not to print up so much money. But it has printed up a lot of money in the last year, and we are very likely, if we're not careful, to have a lot of inflation because of that. That problems that may result from that might be an incentive for more fiscally responsible policies. In other words, we're going to have some sentiment from the grassroots that it simply is inappropriate to print up money and try to solve our problems by inflating the currency.
I have another question that came in from Joni. Who says, hi, Richard, the president spoke this morning about helping to create more jobs through various means. One way was to create more jobs in the field of energy, also cars that go more miles to the gallon. Do you think he will implement these, and will they work? And quite frankly, without wanting to answer Joni's question for you, it appears to me that Joni's talking about exactly the same failed policy that prolonged the Great Depression, this idea of just mindlessly throwing jobs out there and hoping that somehow, you know, the economy gets fired up again.
Right. We tried that. Of course, the WPA and other agencies were involved in that. For example, another one was the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority. We ended up concentrating a huge amount of money in the Tennessee Valley Authority, and we found out the net result was it didn't even particularly prosper the Tennessee Valley area. And so the idea that we're going to concentrate federal money into a particular product or a piece of legislation or into a particular locality, and that is going to end up solving unemployment problems, is really wishful thinking. It simply didn't work that way in the past.
So we're back to basically a sort of grotesquely cynical political expediency here that we've just got to learn to live with, really, haven't we? Because it's gained a momentum of its own, and I don't see it being arrested. I mean, you know, there's always a short-term apparent gain from these things, and once you've given out the jobs, there's no taking them back, really, is there? You can't put them back on them.
It's hard, although, interestingly enough, to use your example from England, Ramsay MacDonald tried a lot of these policies in the 1930s, and he was thrown out. Roosevelt was able to continue to be reelected. He was a very shrewd politician. Ramsay MacDonald, for whatever reason, wasn't quite as shrewd, and Baldwin ended up coming back in for the conservative government. So it appears as though there are ways to challenge these policies and successfully produce policies that will more likely to create prosperity. I mentioned the more limited government programs. It seems as though this is possible. It was done in the United States in the 1920s, and tried again to some extent in the 1980s, and it was effective both times. And the idea that we can go again to massive federal spending and that it will be a cure-all for unemployment, it simply didn't work that way in the 1930s. It's unlikely to work that way today. But we can understand a lot of what's happening, as you say, is because of political expediency, isn't it? If we can understand that, that can at least help us to move toward a more effective policy by saying, hey, we want policies that work economically, not those that may happen to be politically expedient.
Do you get a sense of how Obama is going to stack up, you know, in relation to Roosevelt or anybody else who's had to deal with these problems?
Yeah, it's way too early to tell, but it's interesting that Obama's apparently been reading books on Roosevelt, that he's been studying the 1930s. He's been inspired by the idea that, hey, it's good to do something quickly during the first 100 days. I would disagree with that simply because you need to craft legislation carefully. In the first 100 days, for example, of Roosevelt's administration, he had one piece of legislation that paid silver miners an above-average market wage for their silver. Well, now, that isn't really thinking very clearly about something that's going to help the economy, because all that did was give silver miners an incentive to go out and produce more silver, silver which the economy did not even need because they could receive a federal subsidy if they did so. You need to craft legislation very carefully. It needs to go through a careful vetting process, and at least we can eliminate some of the extremes, perhaps, by doing that. The whole problem with the AAA, paying people not to produce, paying silver miners above market legislation for their silver, all of this reflects legislation that was rammed through that was not carefully thought out. What we need to do is carefully think through the legislation that's going to be passed.
Thank you, Bert. The book, again, is New Deal or Raw Deal, How FDR's Economic Legacy Has Damaged America. One very quick question. We have just about a minute left here, Bert, from a listener called
sure.
Steve Canero. Bert, I like your optimism, but what do you think when the House reversed its initial vote against the Paulson bailout and passed it? It seems that it showed how closed-minded Obama is despite having Volcker in his corner. Thanks, Steve.
You know, that is interesting that that happened. But one interesting thing about even the second vote, you're making a good point. Even that second vote, there was a tremendous amount of opposition. And a lot of the opposition was saying we should not pass hastily ill-considered legislation. Well, now we're finding out that it was hastily done and ill-considered. Maybe that will help us this next time around with the stimulus package by not ramming something through in the first 100 days of Obama's administration, just because Roosevelt rammed some programs through in his first 100 days. And as I suggested, they did not work very well.
Bert, Burton W. Folsom, thank you very much indeed for your time. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Richard, thanks for having me.
Good luck with the book, and everybody, thank you. We will be back again on Thursday at the usual time of 2 p.m. Eastern. This is Richard Martin of Richard Martin's Wake Up Call saying bye-bye. Till then.